very small old friend who had just returned after years at sea. He unscrewed the top of the bottle. It was a sweet cooking sherry, but he drank it down like lemonade. There were other things Graham Coates had noticed while looking for alcohol in the kitchen. There were, for example, knives. Some of them were very sharp. In a drawer, there was even a small stainless steel hacksaw. Graham Coates approved. It would be the very simple solution to the problem in the basement. "Habeas corpus," he said, "or habeas delicti, one of those. If there is no body, then there was no crime. Ergo, quod erat demonstrandum." He took his gun out of his jacket pocket, put it on the kitchen table. He arranged the knives around it in a pattern, like the spokes of a wheel. "Well," he said, in the same tones he had once used to use to persuade innocent boy bands that it was time to sign their contract with him, and to say hello to fame, if not actually fortune, "no time like the present." He pushed three kitchen knives blade down through his belt, placed the hacksaw in his jacket pocket, and then, gun in hand, he went down the cellar stairs. He turned on the lights, blinked at the wine bottles on their side, each in their rack, each covered with a thin layer of dust, and then he was standing beside the iron meat locker door. "Right," he shouted. "You'll be pleased to hear that I'm not going to hurt you. I'll be letting you both go now. All a bit of a mistake. Still, no hard feelings. No use crying over spilt. Stand by the far wall, assume the position, no funny stuff." It was, he reflected as he pulled back the bolts, almost comforting how many clichés already exist for people holding guns. It made Graham Coates feel like one of a brotherhood. Bogart stood beside him, and Cagney, and all the people who shout at each other on Cops. He turned the light on and pulled open the door. Rose's mother stood against the far wall with her back to him. As he came in, she flipped up her skirt and waggled an astonishingly bony brown bottom. His jaw dropped open. That was when Rosie slammed down a length of rusty chain onto Graham Coates's wrist, sending the gun flying across the room. With the enthusiasm and accuracy of a much younger woman, Rosie's mother kicked Graham Coates in the groin, and as he clutched his crotch and doubled up, making noises pitched at a level that only dogs and bats could hear, Rosie and her mother stumbled out of the meat locker. They pushed the door closed, and Rosie pushed shut one of the bolts. They hugged. They were still in the wine cellar when all the lights went off. "It's just the fuses," said Rosie to reassure her mother. She was not certain that she believed it, but she had no other explanation. "You should have locked the door," said her mother, and then, "Ow!" as she stubbed her toe on something and cursed. "On the bright side," said Rosie, "he can't see in the dark either. Just hold my hand. I think the stairs are up this way." Graham Coates was down on all fours on the concrete floor of the meat cellar, in the darkness when the lights went out. There was something hot dripping down his leg. He thought for one uncomfortable moment that he had wet himself before he understood that the blade of one of the knives he had pushed into his belt had cut deeply into the top of his leg. He stopped moving and lay on the floor. He decided that he had been very sensible to have drunk so much. It was practically an anesthetic. He decided to go to sleep. He was not alone in the meat locker. There was someone in there with him. Something that moved on four legs. Somebody growled, "Get up."
"Can't get up. I'm hurt. Want to go to bed."
"You're a pitiful little creature, and you destroy everything you touch. Now get up."
"Would love to," said Graham Coates in the reasonable tones of a drunk. "Can't. Just going to lie on the floor for a bit. Anyway, she bolted the door. I heard her."
He heard a scraping from the other side of the door, as if a bolt was slowly being released. "The door is open. Now, if you stay here, you'll die." An impatient rustling, the swish of a tail, a roar half-muffled in the back of a throat. "Give me your hand and your allegiance. Invite me inside you."
"I don't underst—"
"Give me your hand or bleed to death." In the black of the meat cellar, Graham Coates put out his hand. Someone, something, took it and held it reassuringly. "Now, are you willing to invite me in?" A moment of cold sobriety touched Graham Coates then. He had already gone too far. Nothing he did would make matters worse after all.
"Absolutely," whispered Graham Coates,
and as he said it, he began to change. He could see through the darkness easy as daylight. He thought, but only for a moment, that he saw something beside him, bigger than a man, with sharp, sharp teeth, and then it was gone. And Graham Coates felt wonderful. The blood no longer spurted from his leg. He could see clearly in the darkness. He pulled the knives from his belt, dropped them onto the floor. He pulled off his shoes, too. There was a gun on the ground, but he left it there. Tools were for apes and crows and weaklings. He was no ape. He was a hunter. He pulled himself up onto his hands and his knees, and then he padded, four-footed, out into the wine cellar. He could see the women. They had found the steps up to the house, and they were edging up them blindly, hand in hand in the darkness. One of them was old and stringy. The other was young and tender. The mouth salivated in something that was partly Graham Coates. Fat Charlie left the bridge with his father's green fedora pushed back on his head, and he walked into the dusk. He walked up the rocky beach, slipping on the rocks, splashing into pools. Then he trod on something that moved, a stumble, and he stepped off it. It rose into the air, and it kept rising. Whatever it was enormous. He thought at first that it was the size of an elephant, but it grew bigger still. Light, thought Fat Charlie. He sang aloud, and all the lightning bugs, the fireflies of that place, clustered around him, flickering off and on with their cold green luminescence, and in their light he could make out two eyes bigger than dinner plates, staring down at him from a supercilious reptilian face. He stared back. "Evening," he said cheerfully. A voice from the creature, smooth as buttered oil.
"Hello," it said. "Ding dong. You look remarkably like dinner."
"I'm Charlie Nancy," said Charlie Nancy. "Who are you?"
"I'm Dragon," said the dragon, "and I shall devour you in one slow mouthful, little man in a hat."
Charlie blinked. What would my father do? He wondered. What would Spider have done? He had absolutely no idea. Come on. After all, Spider's sort of part of me. I can do whatever he can do.
You're bored with talking to me now, and you're going to let me pass unhindered, he told the dragon with as much conviction as he was able to muster.
Gosh, good try, but I'm afraid I'm not, said the dragon enthusiastically. Actually, I'm going to eat you.
You aren't scared of limes, are you? Asked Charlie, before remembering that he'd given the lime to Daisy.
The creature laughed scornfully.
I, it said, am frightened of nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing, it said.
Charlie said, Are you extremely frightened of nothing?
Absolutely terrified of it, admitted the dragon.
You know, said Charlie, I have nothing in my pockets. Would you like to see it?
No, said the dragon uncomfortably. I most definitely would not.
There was a flapping of wings like sails, and Charlie was alone on the beach. That, he said, was much too easy. He kept on walking. He made up a song for his walk. Charlie had always wanted to make up songs, but he never did, mostly because of the conviction that if he ever had written a song, someone would have asked him to sing it, and that would not have been a good thing, much as death by hanging would not be a good thing. Now he cared less and less, and he sang his song to the fireflies, who followed him up the hillside. It was a song about meeting the bird woman and finding his brother. He hoped the fireflies were enjoying it. Their light seemed to be pulsing and flickering in time with the tune. The bird woman was waiting for him at the top of the hill. Charlie took off his hat. He pulled the feather from the hatband. Here, this is yours, I believe. She made no move to take it. Our deal's over, said Charlie. I brought your feather. I want my brother. You took him. I want him back. And Auntie's bloodline was not mine to give.
And if I no longer have your brother?
It was hard to tell in the firefly light, but Charlie did not believe that her lips had moved. Her words surrounded him, however, in the cries of nightjars and in the owl's shriek and hoot. I want my brother back, he told her. I want him whole and in one piece and uninjured, and I want him now. Or whatever went on between you and my father over the years was just the prelude, you know, the overture. Charlie had never threatened anyone before. He had no idea how he would carry out his threats, but he had no doubt that he would indeed carry them out.
I had him, she said in the bittern's distant boom, but I left him tongueless, in Tiger's world. I could not hurt your father's line. Tiger could, once he found his courage."
A hush. The night frogs and the night birds were perfectly silent. She stared at him impassively, her face almost part of the shadows. Her hand went into the pocket of her coat.
"Give me the feather," she said.
Charlie put it into her hand. He felt lighter then, as if she had taken more from him than just an old feather. Then she placed something into his hand, something cold and damp. It felt like a lump of meat, and Charlie had to quell the urge to fling it away.
"Return it to him," she said in the voice of the night. "He has no quarrel with me now."
"How do I get to Tiger's world?"
"How did you get here?" she asked,
sounding almost amused. And the night was complete, and Charlie was alone on the hill. He opened his hand and looked at the lump of meat that sat there, floppy and ridged. It looked like a tongue, and he knew whose tongue it had to be. He put the fedora back on his head, and he thought, "Put my thinking cap on." And as he thought it, it didn't seem so funny. The green fedora was not a thinking cap, but it was the kind of hat that would be worn by someone who not only thought, but also came to conclusions of an important and vital kind. He imagined the world as a web. It blazed in his mind, connecting him to everyone he knew. The strand that connected him to Spider was strong and bright, and it burned with a cold light like a lightning bug or a star. Spider had been a part of him, once. He held on to this knowledge, let the web fill his mind, and in his hand was his brother's tongue. That had been a part of Spider until very recently, and it wished devoutly to be part of him again. Living things remember. The wild light of the web burned about him. All Charlie needed to do was follow it. He followed it, and the fireflies clustered around and travelled with him.
"Hey," he said, "it's me."
Spider made a small, terrible noise. In the glimmer of firefly light, Spider looked awful. He looked hunted, and he looked hurt. There were scabs on his face and chest. "I think this is probably yours," said Charlie. Spider took the tongue from his brother with an exaggerated thank you gesture, placed it into his mouth, pushed it in, and held it down. Charlie watched and waited as the tongue took root. Soon Spider seemed satisfied. He moved his mouth experimentally, pushing the tongue to one side and then to the other, as if he were preparing to shave off a moustache, opening his mouth widely and waggling his tongue about. He closed his mouth and stood up. Finally, in a voice that was still a little wobbly around the edges, he said,
"Nice hat."
Rosie made it to the top of the steps first, and she pushed open the wine cellar door. She stumbled into the house. She waited for her mother. Then she slammed and bolted the cellar door behind her. The power was out up here as well, but the moon was high and nearly full, and after the darkness, the pallid moonlight coming through the kitchen windows might as well have been floodlighting.
"Boys and girls come out to play," thought Rosie. "The moon does shine as bright as day."
"Phone the police," said her mother.
"Where's the phone?"
"How the hell should I know where the phone is? He's still down there."
"Right,"
said Rosie, wondering whether she should find a phone to call the police or just get out of the house, but before she'd reached a decision, it was too late. There was a bang so loud it hurt her ears, and the door to the cellar crashed open. The shadow came out of the cellar. It was real. She knew it was real. She was looking at it. But it was impossible. It was the shadow of a great cat, shaggy and huge. Strangely, though, when the moonlight touched it, the shadow seemed darker. Rosie could not see its eyes, but she knew it was looking at her, and that it was hungry. It was going to kill her. This was where it would end. Her mother said,
"It wants you, Rosie."
"I know."
Rosie picked up the nearest large object, a wooden block that had once held knives, and she threw it at the shadow as hard as she could, and then, without waiting to see if it made contact, she moved as fast as she could out of the kitchen into the hallway. She knew where the front door was. Something dark, something four-footed, moved faster. It bounded over her head, landed almost silently in front of her. Rosie backed up against the wall, Her mouth was dry. The beast was between them and the front door, and it was padding back slowly toward Rosie, as if it had all the time in the world. Her mother ran out of the kitchen then ran past Rosie, tottered down the moonlit corridor toward the great shadow, her arms flailing. With her thin fists, she punched the thing in the ribs. There was a pause, as if the world was holding its breath, and then it turned on her. A blur of motion, and Rosie's mother was down on the ground, while the shadow shook her like a dog with a rag doll between its teeth. The doorbell rang. Rosie wanted to call for help, but instead she found she was screaming loudly and insistently. Rosie, when confronted with an unexpected spider in a bathtub, was capable of screaming like a B-movie actress on her first encounter with a man in a rubber suit. Now she was in a dark house containing a shadowy tiger and a potential serial killer, and one, perhaps both of those entities, had just attacked her mother. Her head thought of a couple of courses of action. The gun. The gun was down in the cellar. She ought to go down and get the gun. Or the door. She could try to get past her mother and the shadow and unlock the front door. But her lungs and her mouth would only scream. Something banged at the front door. "They're trying to break in," she thought. "They won't get through that door. It's solid." Her mother lay on the floor in a patch of moonlight, and the shadow crouched over her, and it threw back its head, and it roared. A deep, rattling roar of fear and challenge and possession. "I'm hallucinating," thought Rosie with a wild certainty. "I've been locked up in a cellar for 2 days, and now I'm hallucinating. There is no tiger." By the same token, she was certain that there was no pale woman in the moonlight, even though she could see her walking down the corridor. A woman with blonde hair and the long, long legs and narrow hips of a dancer. The woman stopped when she reached the shadow of the tiger. She said, "Hello, Graham." The shadow beast lifted its massive head and growled. "Don't think you can hide from me in that silly animal costume," said the woman. She did not look pleased. Rosie realized that she could see the window through the woman's upper body, and she backed up until she was pressing hard against the wall. The beast growled again, this time a little more uncertainly. The woman said, "I don't believe in ghosts, Graham. I spent my whole life not believing in ghosts. And then I met you. You let Morris's career run aground. You steal from us. You murder me. And finally, to add insult to injury, you force me to believe in ghosts." The shadowy big cat shape was whimpering now and backing down the hall. "Don't think you can avoid me like that, you useless little man. You can pretend to be a tiger all you like. You aren't a tiger. You're a rat. No, that's an insult to a noble and numerous species of rodent. You're less than a rat. You're a gerbil. You're a stoat." Rosie ran down the hall. She ran past the shadow beast, past her fallen mother. She ran through the pale woman, and it felt like she was passing through fog. She reached the front door and began feeling for the bolts. In her head or in the world, Rosie could hear an argument. Someone was saying, "Pay no attention to her, idiot. She can't touch you. It's just a duppy. She's barely real. Get the girl. Stop the girl." And someone else was replying, "You certainly do have a valid point here, but I'm not convinced that you've taken all these circumstances into account, vis-a-vis, well, discretion, better part of valour, if you follow me." "I lead, you follow, but..." "What I want to know," said the pale woman, "is just how ghostly you currently are. I mean, I can't touch people. I can't really even touch things. I can touch ghosts." The pale woman aimed a serious kick at the beast's face. The shadow cat hissed and took a step back, and the foot missed it by less than an inch. The next kick connected, and the beast yowled. Another kick, hard against the place the cat's shadowy nose would be, and the beast made the noise of a cat being shampooed, a lonely wail of horror and outrage, of shame and defeat. The corridor was filled with the sound of a dead woman laughing, a laugh of exultation and delight. "Stoat," said the pale woman's voice again. "Graham Stoat." A cold wind blew through the house. Rosie pulled the last of the bolts, and she turned the lock. The front door fell open. There were beams of flashlights, blinding bright. People, cars. A woman's voice said, "It's one of the missing tourists." And then she said, "My God." Rosie turned.
In the flashlight's beam, Rosie could see her mother, crumpled on the tiled floor, and beside her, shoeless and unconscious and unmistakably human, Graham Coates. There was a red liquid splashed all around them like crimson paint, and Rosie found herself, for a breath, unable to work out what it was. A woman was talking to her. She was saying, "You're Rosie Noah. My name's Daisy. Let's find somewhere for you to sit down. Would you like to sit down?" Someone must have found the fuse box, for at that moment the lights went on all over the house. A large man in a police uniform was bent over the bodies. He looked up and said, "It is definitely Mr. Finnegan. He is not breathing." Rosie said, "Yes, please. I would like to sit down very much." Charlie sat down beside Spider on the edge of the cliff, in the moonlight, his legs dangling over the side. "You know," he said, "you used to be a part of me, when we were kids." Spider put his head on one side. "Really?" "I think so." "Well, that would explain a few things." He held out his hand. A seven-legged clay spider sat on the back of his fingers, tasting the air. "So what now? Are you going to take me back or something?" Charlie's brow crinkled. "I think you've turned out better than you would have done if you were part of me, and you've had a lot more fun." Spider said, "Rosie, Tiger knows about Rosie. We have to do something." "Of course we do," said Charlie. It was like bookkeeping, he thought. You put entries in one column, deduct them from another, and if you've done it correctly, everything should come out right at the bottom of the page. He took his brother's hand. They stood up and took a step forward, off the cliff. And everything was bright. A cold wind blew between the worlds. Charlie said, "You're not the magical bit of me, you know."
"I'm not."
Spider took another step. Stars were falling now by the dozen, streaking their way across the dark sky. Someone somewhere was playing high, sweet music on a flute. Another step, and now distant sirens were blaring.
"No," said Charlie, "you're not.
Mrs. Dunwoody thought you were, I think. She split us apart, but she never really understood what she was doing. We're more like two halves of a starfish. You grew up into a whole person. And so," he said, realizing it was true as he said it, "did I." They stood on the cliff edge in the dawn. An ambulance was on its way up the hill, lights flashing, and another behind that. They parked by the side of the road, beside a cluster of police cars. Daisy seemed to be telling everyone what to do. "Not much that we can do here. Not now," said Charlie. "Come on." The last of the fireflies left him, and blinked its way to sleep. They rode the first minibus of the morning back to Williamstown. Maeve Livingstone sat upstairs in the library of Graham Coates's house, surrounded by Graham Coates's art and books and DVDs, and she stared out of the window. Down below, the island's emergency services were putting Rosie and her mother into one ambulance, Graham Coates into another. She had, she reflected, really enjoyed kicking the beast thing that Graham Coates had become. It was the most profoundly satisfying thing she had done since she had been killed, although, if she were to be honest with herself, she would have to admit that Dancing with Mr. Nancy came in an extremely close second. He had been remarkably spry and nimble on his feet. She was tired.
"Maeve!"
"Morris?"
She looked around her, but the room was empty. "I wouldn't want to disturb you if you were still busy, pet."
"That's very sweet of you," she said, "but I think I'm done."
The walls of the library were beginning to fade. They were losing colour and form. The world behind the walls was starting to show, and in its light she saw a small figure in a smart suit waiting for her. Her hand crept into his. She said,
"Where are we going now, Morris?"
He told her.
"Oh, well, that will be a pleasant change," she said. "I've always wanted to go there."
And hand in hand, they went. Chapter 14, which comes to several conclusions. Charlie woke to a banging on a door. Disoriented, he looked around. He was in a hotel room, and various unlikely events clustered inside his head like moths around a naked bulb,
and while he tried to make sense of them, he let his feet get up and walk him to the hotel room door. He blinked at the diagram on the back of the door, which told him where to go in case of fire, trying to remember the events of the previous night. Then he unlocked the door and pulled it open. Daisy looked up at him. She said, "Were you asleep in that hat?" Charlie put his hand up and felt his head. There was definitely a hat on it. "Yes," he said, "I think I must have been."
"Bless," she said. "Well, at least you took your shoes off. You know you missed all the excitement last night."
"I did."
"Brush your teeth," she said helpfully, "and change your shirt." "Yes, you did. While you were..."
And then she hesitated. It seemed quite improbable, on reflection, that he really had vanished in the middle of a séance. These things did not happen. Not in the real world.
"While you weren't there, I got the police chief to go to Graham Coates's house. He had those tourists..."
"Tourists?"
"It was what he said at dinner. Something about us sending the two people in, the two at the house. It was your fiancée and her mother. He'd locked them up in his basement."
"Are they okay?"
"They're both in the hospital."
"Oh.
Her mum's in rough shape. I think your fiancée will be okay."
"Will you stop calling her that? She's not my fiancée. She ended the engagement."
"Yes, but you didn't, did you?"
"She's not in love with me," said Charlie flatly. "Now, I'm going to brush my teeth and change my shirt, and I need a certain amount of privacy."
"You should shower too," she said, "and that hat smells like a cigar."
"It's a family heirloom," he told her, and he went into the bathroom and locked the door behind him. The hospital was a 10-minute walk from the hotel, and Spider was sitting in the waiting room, holding a dog-eared copy of Entertainment Weekly magazine, as if he was actually reading it. Charlie tapped him on the shoulder, and Spider jumped. He looked up warily, and then, seeing his brother, he relaxed, but not much. "They said I had to wait out here," Spider said, "because I'm not a relation or anything."
Charlie boggled. "Well, why didn't you just tell them you were a relative, or a doctor?"
Spider looked uncomfortable.
"Well, it's easy to do that stuff if you don't care. If it doesn't matter if I go in or I don't, it's easy to go in. But now it matters. And I'd hate to get in the way or do something wrong. And I mean, what if I tried and they said no, and then... What are you grinning about?"
"Nothing, really," said Charlie. "It just all sounds a bit familiar. Come on, let's go and find Rosie. You know," he said to Daisy as they set off down a random corridor, "there are two ways to walk through a hospital. Either you look like you belong there. Here you go, Spider. White coat on back of door, just your size, put it on. Or you should look so out of place that no one will complain that you're there. They'll just leave it for someone else to sort out." He began to hum.
"What's that song?" asked Daisy.
"It's called Yellow Bird," said Spider.
Charlie pushed his hat back on his head, and they walked into Rosie's hospital room. Rosie was sitting up in bed, reading a magazine, and looking worried. When she saw the three of them come in, she looked more worried. She looked from Spider to Charlie, and back again.
"You're both a long way from home," was all she said.
"We all are," said Charlie. "Now you've met Spider. This is Daisy. She's in the police."
"I'm not sure that I am anymore," said Daisy. "I'm probably in all kinds of hot water."
"You're the one who was there last night. The one who got the island police to come up to the house."
Rosie stopped. She said,
"Any word on Graham Coates?"
"He's in intensive care, just like your mum."
"Well, if she comes to before he does," said Rosie, "I expect she'll kill him."
Then she said,
"They won't talk to me about my mum's condition. They just say that it's very serious, and they'll tell me as soon as there's anything to tell."
She looked at Charlie with clear eyes.
"She's not as bad as you think she is, really. Not when you get time to know her. We had a lot of time to talk, locked up in the dark. She's all right."
She blew her nose. Then she said,
"They don't think she's going to make it. They haven't directly said that to me, but they sort of said it in a not-saying-it sort of way. It's funny. I thought she'd live through anything."
Charlie said, "Me too. I figured even if there was a nuclear war, it would still leave radioactive cockroaches and your mum." Daisy stepped on his foot. She said,
"Do they know anything more about what hurt her?"
"I told them," said Rosie. "There was some kind of animal in the house. Maybe it was just Graham Coates. I mean, it sort of was him, but it was sort of someone else. She distracted it from me, and it went for her."
She had explained it all as best she could to the island police that morning. She had decided not to talk about the blonde ghost woman. Sometimes minds snap under pressure, and she thought it best if people did not know that hers had. Rosie broke off. She was staring at Spider as if she had only just remembered who he was. She said,
"I still hate you, you know."
Spider said nothing, but a miserable expression crept across his face, and he no longer looked like a doctor. Now he looked like a man who had borrowed a white coat from behind a door and was worried that someone would notice. A dreamlike tone came into her voice.
"Only," she said, "only when I was in the dark, I thought that you were helping me, that you were keeping the animal away. What happened to your face? It's all scratched."
"It was an animal," said Spider.
"You know," she said, "now I see you both at once. You don't look anything alike at all."
"I'm the good-looking one," said Charlie, and Daisy's foot pressed down on his toes for the second time.
"Bless," said Daisy quietly, and then slightly louder, "Charlie, there's something we need to talk about outside, now."
They went out into the hospital corridor, leaving Spider inside.
"What?" said Charlie.
What?
Said Daisy.
"What have we got to talk about?"
"Nothing."
"Then why are we out here?"
"You heard her. She hates him. We shouldn't have left them alone together. She's probably killed him by now."
Daisy looked up at him with the kind of expression that Jesus might have given someone who had just explained that he was probably allergic to bread and fishes, so could he possibly do him a quick chicken salad?
There was pity in that expression, along with almost infinite compassion.
She touched a finger to her lips and pulled him back towards the door. He looked back into the hospital room. Rosie did not appear to be killing Spider. Quite the opposite, if anything.
"Oh," said Charlie.
They were kissing. Put like that, and you could be forgiven for presuming that this was a normal kiss, all lips and skin and possibly even a little tongue. You'd miss how he smiled, how his eyes glowed, and then, after the kiss was done, how he stood, like a man who had just discovered the art of standing and had figured out how to do it better than anyone else who would ever come along. Charlie turned his attention back to the corridor, to find Daisy in conversation with several doctors and the police officer they had encountered the previous evening.
"Well, we always had him figured as a bad man," the police officer was saying to Daisy. "I mean, frankly, you only get this kind of behaviour from foreigners. The local people, they simply wouldn't do that kind of thing."
"Obviously not," said Daisy.
"Very, very grateful,"
said the police chief, patting her shoulder in a way that set Daisy's teeth on edge.
"This little lady saved that woman's life,"
he told Charlie, giving his shoulder a patronizing pat for good measure, before setting off with the doctors down the corridor.
"So what's happening?" asked Charlie.
"Well, Graham Coates is dead," she said, "more or less, and they don't hold out any hope for Rosie's mum either."
"I see," said Charlie.
He thought about this, then he finished thinking and came to a decision. Said, "Would you mind if I just chatted to my brother for a bit? I think he and I need to talk."
"I'm going back to the hotel anyway. I'm going to check my email. Probably going to have to say sorry on the phone a lot. Find out if I still have a career."
"But you're a hero, aren't you?"
"I don't think that's what anyone was paying me for," she said a little wanly. "Come and find me at the hotel when you're done."
Spider and Charlie walked down the Williamstown High Street in the morning sun.
"You know, that really is a good hat," said Spider.
"You really think so?"
"Yeah. Can I try it on?"
Charlie gave Spider the green fedora. Spider put it on, looked at his reflection in the shop window. He made a face and gave Charlie the hat back.
"Well," he said, disappointed, "it looks good on you anyway."
Charlie pushed his fedora back onto his head. Some hats can only be worn if you're willing to be jaunty, to set them at an angle and to walk beneath them with a spring in your stride, as if you're only a step away from dancing. They demand a lot of you. This hat was one of those, and Charlie was up to it. He said,
"Rosie's mum is dying."
"Yeah."
"I really, really never liked her.
I didn't know her as well as you did, but given time, I'm sure I would have really, really disliked her too."
Charlie said, "We have to try and save her life, don't we?" He said it without enthusiasm, like someone pointing out it was time to visit the dentist.
"I don't think we can do things like that."
"Dad did something like it for Mum. He got her better, for a while."
"But that was him. I don't know how we'd do that."
Charlie said.
The place at the end of the world, with the caves.
Beginning of the world, not the end.
What about it?
Can we just get there, without all the candles and herbs, malarkey?
Spider was quiet, then he nodded.
I think so.
They turned together, turned in a direction that wasn't usually there, and they walked away from the Williamstown High Street.
Now the sun was rising,
and Charlie and Spider walked across a beach littered with skulls. They were not proper human skulls, and they covered the beach like yellow pebbles.
Charlie avoided them where he could, while Spider crunched his way through them.
At the end of the beach, they took a left turn that was left to absolutely everything, and the mountains at the beginning of the world towered above them, and the cliffs fell away below. Charlie remembered the last time he was here, and it seemed like 1,000 years ago.
"Where is everyone?"
he said aloud, and his voice echoed against the rocks and came back to him. He said loudly,
"Hello?"
And then they were there, watching him.
All of them. They seemed grander now, less human, more animal, wilder.
He realized that he had seen them as people last time because he had expected to meet people, but they were not people. Arrayed on the rocks above them were lion and elephant, crocodile and python, rabbit and scorpion, and the rest of them. Hundreds of them. And they stared at him with eyes unsmiling. Animals he recognized, animals that no one living would be able to identify. All the animals that have ever been in stories, all the animals that people have dreamed of, worshipped or placated. Charlie saw all of them. It's one thing, he thought, singing for your life in a room filled with diners on the spur of the moment with a gun barrel in the ribs of the girl thought Charlie, I can worry about that later. Right now, he badly wanted either to breathe into a brown paper bag or to vanish.
There must be hundreds of them, said Spider, and there was awe in his voice.
There was a flurry in the air on a nearby rock, which resolved itself into the bird woman. She folded her arms and stared at them.
Whatever it is you're going to do, Spider said, you better do it soon. They aren't going to wait around forever.
Charlie's mouth was dry.
Right, Spider said. So, what exactly do we do now?
We sing to them, said Charlie simply.
What?
It's how we fix things. I figured it out. We just sing it all, you and I.
I don't understand. Sing what?
Charlie said,
the song.
You sing the song. You fix things. Now he sounded desperate.
The song.
Spider's eyes were like puddles after the rain, and Charlie saw things in them he had not seen before. Affection, perhaps, and confusion, and mostly apology.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Lion watched them from the side of a boulder. Monkey looked at them from the top of a tree. And Tiger. Charlie saw Tiger. It was walking gingerly towards them, on 4 feet. Its face was swollen and bruised, but there was a glint in its eyes, and it looked as if it would be more than happy to even the score. Charlie opened his mouth. A small croaking noise came out, as if Charlie had recently swallowed a particularly nervous frog.
"It's no use," he whispered to Spider. "This was a stupid idea, wasn't it?"
"Yep."
"Do you think we can just go away again?"
Charlie's nervous glance swept the mountainside and the caves, took in each of the hundreds of totem creatures from before the dawn of time. There was one he had not seen the last time he had looked. A small man, with lemon-yellow gloves and a pencil-thin moustache and no fedora hat to cover his thinning hair. The old man winked when he caught Charlie's gaze. It wasn't much, but it was enough. Charlie filled his lungs, and he began to sing. "I am Charlie," he sang. "I am Anansi's son. Listen as I sing my song. Listen to my life." He sang them the song of a boy who was half a god, and who was broken into two by an old woman with a grudge. He sang of his father, and he sang of his mother. He sang of names and words,
of the building blocks beneath the real, the worlds that make worlds, the truths beneath the way things are. He sang of appropriate ends and just conclusions for those who would have hurt him and his. He sang the world. It was a good song, and it was his song. Sometimes it had words, and sometimes it didn't have any words at all. As he sang, all the creatures listening began to clap and to stamp and to hum along. Charlie felt like he was the conduit for a great song that took in all of them. He sang of birds, of the magic of looking up and seeing them in flight, of the sheen of the sun on a wing feather in the morning. The totem creatures were dancing now, the dances of their kind. The bird woman danced the wheeling dance of birds, fanning her tail feathers, tossing back her beak. There was only one creature on the mountainside who did not dance. Tiger lashed his tail. He was not clapping or singing or dancing. His face was bruised purple, and his body was covered in welts and in bite marks. He had padded down the rocks, a step at a time, until he was close to Charlie. "The songs aren't yours," he growled. Charlie looked at him, and sang about Tiger, and about Graham Coates, and those who would prey upon the innocent. He turned. Spider was looking up at him with admiration. Tiger roared in anger, and Charlie took the roar and wound his song around it. Then he did the roar himself, just like Tiger had done it. Well, the roar began just as Tiger's roar had, but then Charlie changed it, so it became a really goofy sort of roar, and all the creatures watching from the rock started to laugh. They couldn't help it. Charlie did the goofy roar again. Like any impersonation, like any perfect caricature, it had the effect of making what it made fun of intrinsically ridiculous. No one would ever hear Tiger roar again without hearing Charlie's roar underneath it. "Goofy sort of a roar," they'd say. Tiger turned his back on Charlie. He loped through the crowd roaring as he ran, which only made the crowd laugh the harder, and Tiger angrily retreated back into his cave. Spider gestured with his hands, a curt movement. There was a rumble, and the mouth of Tiger's cave collapsed in a small rock slide. Spider looked satisfied. Charlie kept singing. He sang the song of Rosie Noah, and the song of Rosie's mother. He sang a long life for Mrs. Noah, and all the happiness that she deserved. He sang of his life, all of their lives, and in his song he saw the pattern of their lives as a web that a fly had blundered into, and with his song he wrapped the fly, made certain it would not escape, and he repaired the web with new strands. And now the song was coming to its natural end. Charlie realized, with no little surprise, that he enjoyed singing to other people, and he knew, at that moment, that this was what he would spend the rest of his life doing. He would sing. Not big, magical songs that made worlds or recreated existence, just small songs that would make people happy for a breath, make them move, make them, for a little while, forget their problems. And he knew that there would always be the fear before performing, the stage fright, that would never go away. But he also understood that it would be like jumping into a swimming pool, only uncomfortably chill for a few seconds, and then the discomfort would pass, and it would be good. Never this good. Never this good again, but good enough. And then he was done. Charlie hung his head. The creatures on the clifftop let the last notes die away. Stop stamping, stop clapping, stop dancing. Charlie took off his father's green fedora and fanned his face with it. Under his breath, Spider said, "That was amazing." "You could have done it too," said Charlie. "I don't think so. What was happening at the end? I felt you doing something, but I couldn't really tell what it was." "I fixed things," said Charlie. "For us, I think. I'm not really sure." And he wasn't. Now the song was over, the content of the song was unraveling like a dream in the morning. He pointed to the cave mouth that was blocked by rocks. "Did you do that?" "Yeah," said Spider. "Seemed the least I could do. Tiger will dig his way out eventually, though. I wish I'd done something worse than just shut the door on him, to be honest." "Not to worry," said Charlie. "I did. Something much worse." He watched the animals disperse. His father was nowhere to be seen, which did not surprise him. "Come on," he said. "We ought to be getting back." Spider went back to see Rosie at visiting time.
He was carrying a large box of chocolates, the largest that the hospital gift shop sold.
"For you," he said.
"Thanks." "They told me," she said, "that they think my mum's going to pull through. Apparently she opened her eyes and asked for porridge. The doctor said it's a miracle."
"Yep, your mother asking for food certainly sounds like a miracle to me."
She swatted his arm with her hand, then left her hand resting on his arm.
"You know," she said after a while, "you're going to think this is silly of me, but when I was in the dark with Mum, I thought that you were helping me. I felt like you were keeping the beast at bay, that if you hadn't have done what you were doing, he would have killed us."
I probably helped."
"Really?"
"I don't know. I think so. I was in trouble as well, and I thought about you."
"Were you in very big trouble?"
"Enormous, yes."
"Will you pour me a glass of water, please?"
He did. She said,
"Spider, what do you do?"
"Do?"
"For a job."
"Whatever I feel like doing."
"I think," she said, "I may stay here for a bit. The nurses have been telling me how much they need teachers here on the island. I'd like to see that I was making a difference."
"That might be fun."
"And what would you do if I did?"
"Oh, well, if you were here, I'm sure I could find something to keep me busy."
Their fingers twined, tight as a ship's knot.
"Do you think we can make this work?" she asked.
"I think so," said Spider soberly. "And if I get bored with you, I'll just go away and do something else, so not to worry."
"Oh," said Rosie, "I'm not worried."
And she wasn't. There was steel in her voice, beneath the softness. You could tell where her mother got it from. Charlie found Daisy on a deck chair out on the beach. He thought she was asleep in the sun. When his shadow touched her, she said,
"Hello, Charlie."
She didn't open her eyes.
"How did you know it was me?" "Your hat smells like a cigar. Are you going to be getting rid of it soon?"
"No," said Charlie. "I told you, family heirloom. I plan to wear it till I die, then leave it to my children."
"So, do you still have a job with the police force?"
"Sort of," she said. "My boss said that it's been decided that what I was suffering from was nervous exhaustion brought on by overwork, and I'm on sick leave until I feel well enough to come back."
"Ah, when will that be?"
"Not sure," she said. "Can you pass the suntan oil?"
He had a box in his pocket. He took it out and put it on the arm of the deck chair.
"In a minute. He paused. "You know," he said, "we've already done the big embarrassing one of these at gunpoint."
He opened the box. "But this is for you. From me. Well, Rosie gave it back to me. And we can swap it for one you like. Pick out a different one. Probably it won't even fit. But it's yours. If you want it. And, me."
She reached into the box and took out the engagement ring.
"Hmph. All right," she said. "As long as you're not just doing it to get the lime back."
Tiger prowled. His tail lashed irritably from side to side as he paced back and forth across the mouth of his cave. His eyes burned like emerald torches in the shadows.
"Whole world and everything used to be mine," said Tiger.
"Moon and stars and sun and stories. I owned them all."
"I feel it incumbent on me to point out," said a small voice from the back of the cave, "that you said that already."
Tiger paused in his pacing. He turned then, and insinuated himself into the back of his cave, rippling as he walked, like a fur rug over hydraulic springs. He padded back until he came to the carcass of an ox, and he said in a quiet voice,
"I beg your pardon."
There was a scrabbling from inside the carcass. The tip of a nose protruded from the ribcage.
"Actually," it said, "I was, so to speak, agreeing with you. That was what I was doing."
Little white hands pulled a thin strip of dried meat from between two ribs, revealing a small animal the colour of dirty snow. It might have been an albino mongoose, or perhaps some particularly shifty kind of weasel in its winter coat. It had a scavenger's eyes.
"Whole world and everything used to be mine," said Tiger. "Moon and stars and sun and stories, I owned them all."
Then he said,
"Would have been mine again."
Tiger stared down at the little beast. Then without warning,
One huge paw descended, smashing the ribcage, breaking the carcass into foul-smelling fragments, pinning the little animal to the floor. It wriggled and writhed, but it could not escape.
"You are here," said Tiger, his huge head nose to nose with the pale animal's tiny head. "You are here under my sufferance. Do you understand that? Because the next time you say something irritating, I shall bite your head off."
"Oomph,"
said the weaselly thing. "You wouldn't like it if I bit off your head, would you?"
"Oomph,"
said the smaller animal. Its eyes were a pale blue, two chips of ice, and they glinted as it twisted uncomfortably beneath the weight of the huge paw. "So will you promise me that you will behave, and you will be quiet?" rumbled the tiger. He lifted his paw a little to allow the beast to speak.
"Indeedy," said the small white thing, extremely politely. Then, with one stoat-like movement, it twisted and sank its sharp little teeth into Tiger's paw. Tiger bellowed in pain, whipped the paw back, sending the little animal flying through the air. It struck the rock ceiling, bounced over to a ledge, and from there it darted, like a dirty white streak, to the very back of the cave, where the ceiling got low and close to the floor, and where there were many hiding places for a small animal, places a larger animal could not go. Tiger padded as far back into the cave as it could easily walk.
"You think I can't wait?" he asked. "You have to come out sooner or later. I'm not going anywhere." Tiger lay down.
He closed his eyes, and soon began to make fairly convincing snoring noises. After about half an hour of snoring from Tiger, the pale animal crept out from the rocks and slipped from shadow to shadow, making for a large bone that still had plenty of good meat on it, if he didn't mind a certain rankness, and it didn't. Still, to get the bone it would have to pass the tiger. It lurked in the shadows, then it ventured out on little silent feet. As it passed the sleeping tiger, a forepaw shot out, and a claw slammed down on the creature's tail, pinning it down. Another paw held the little creature behind the neck. The great cat opened its eyes. "Frankly," it said, "we appear to be stuck with each other. So all I'm asking is that you make an effort. We can both make an effort. I rather doubt that we'll ever be friends, but perhaps we could learn to tolerate each other."
"I take your point," said the small ferrety thing. "Needs must, as they say, when the devil drives."
"That's an example of what I'm saying," said Tiger. "You just have to learn when to keep your mouth shut."
"It's an ill wind," said the little animal, "that blows nobody any good."
"Now you're irritating me again," said Tiger. "I'm trying to tell you, don't irritate me, and I won't bite off your head."
"You keep using the phrase, bite my head off. Now, when you say, bite my head off, I take it I can assume that this is actually some kind of metaphorical statement implying that you'll shout at me, perhaps rather angrily?"
"Bite your head off, then crunch it, then chew it, then swallow it," said Tiger. "Neither of us can leave until Anansi's child forgets we're here. The way that bastard seems to have arranged things, even if I kill you in the morning, you'll be reincarnated back in this blasted cave by the end of the afternoon. So don't irritate me."
"Ah, well, another day," said the small white animal.
"If you say another dollar," said Tiger, "I will be irritated, and there will be serious consequences. Don't say anything irritating. Do you understand?"
There was a brief silence in the cave at the end of the world. It was broken by a small, weaselly voice saying,
"Absolutely!"
It started to say, "Ow!" but the noise was suddenly and effectively silenced. And then there was nothing in that place but the sound of crunching. The thing they don't tell you about coffins in the literature, because frankly it's not much of a selling point to the people who are buying them, is just how comfortable they are. Mr. Nancy was extremely satisfied with his coffin. Now that all the excitement was over, he'd gone back to his coffin and was comfortably dozing. Every once in a while he would wake and remember where he was, then he'd roll over and go back to sleep. The grave, as has been pointed out, is a fine place, not to mention a private one, and is an excellent place to get a little downtime. 6 feet down, best can there is. Another 20 years or so, he thought, and he would have to think about getting up. He opened one eye when the funeral started. He could hear them up above him. Callian Higgler, and the Bustamonte woman, and the other one, the thin one,
not to mention a small horde of grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren, all of them sighing and wailing and crying their eyes out for the late Mrs. Dunwiddie. Mr. Nancy thought about pushing one hand up through the turf and grabbing Kellyanne Higgler's ankle. It was something he'd wanted to do ever since he saw Carrie at a drive-in 30 years earlier, but now the opportunity presented itself, he found himself able to resist the temptation. Honestly, he couldn't be bothered. She'd only scream and have a heart attack and die, and then the damn Garden of Rest would get even more crowded than it already was. Too much like hard work, anyway. There were good dreams to be dreamed in the world beneath the soil. 20 years, he thought. Maybe 25. By that time, he might even have grandchildren. It's always interesting to see how the grandchildren turn out. He could hear Kellyanne Higgler wailing and carrying on up above him. Then she stopped her sobbing long enough to announce,
"Still, it's not as if she don't have a good life and a long one. That woman's 103 years old when she passes from us." 104,
said an irritated voice from under the ground beside him. Mr. Nancy reached one insubstantial arm out and tapped the new coffin sharply on the side.
"Keep it down, dear woman," he barked. "Some of us is trying to sleep."
Rosie had made it clear to Spider that she expected him to get a steady job, the kind that involved getting up in the morning and going somewhere. So one morning, the day before Rosie was to be discharged from the hospital, Spider got up early and went down to the town library. He logged on to the library computer, sauntered onto the internet, and, very carefully, cleared out all Graham Coates' remaining bank accounts, the ones that the police forces of several continents had so far failed to find. He arranged for the stud farm in Argentina to be sold. He bought a small, off-the-peg company, endowed it with the money, and applied for charitable status. He sent off an email, in the name of Roger Bronstein, hiring a lawyer to administer the foundation's business, and suggested that the lawyer might wish to seek out Miss Rosie Noah, late of London, currently of St. Andrews, and hire her to do good. Rosie was hired. Her first task was to find office space. Following this, Spider spent 4 full days walking and at night sleeping on the beach that circled most of the island, tasting the food in each of the dining establishments he encountered along the way until he came to Dawson's Fish Shack. He tried the fried flying fish, the boiled green figs, the grilled chicken and the coconut pie, then he went back into the kitchen and found the chef, who was also the owner, and offered him money enough for partnership and cooking lessons. Dawson's Fish Shack is now a restaurant, and Mr. Dawson has retired. Sometimes Spider's out front, and sometimes he's back in the kitchen. You go down there and look for him. You'll see him. The food is the best on the island. He's fatter than he used to be, though not as fat as he'll wind up if he keeps tasting everything he cooks. Not that Rosie minds. She does some teaching, and some helping out, and a lot of doing good, and if she ever misses London, she never lets it show. Rosie's mother, on the other hand, misses London continually and vocally, but takes any suggestion that she might want to return there as an attempt to part her from her as yet unborn, and for that matter unconceived, grandchildren. Nothing would give this author greater pleasure than to be able to assure you that following her return from the Valley of the Shadow of Death, Rosie's mother became a new person, a jolly woman with a kind word for everyone, that her newfound appetite for food was only matched by her appetite for life and all it had to offer. Alas, respect for the truth compels perfect honesty, and the truth is that when she came out of hospital, Rosie's mother was still herself, just as suspicious and uncharitable as ever, although significantly more frail, and now given to sleeping with the light on. She announced that she would be selling her flat in London, and would move to wherever in the world Spider and Rosie were, to be near her grandchildren. And, as time went on, she would drop pointed comments about the lack of grandchildren, the quantity and motility of Spider's spermatozoa, the frequency and positions of Spider and Rosie's sexual relations, and the relative cheapness and ease of in vitro fertilization, to the point where Spider seriously began to think about not going to bed with Rosie anymore, just to spite Rosie's mother. He thought about this for about 11 seconds one afternoon, while Rosie's mother was handing them photocopies of an article from a magazine that she had found, which suggested that Rosie should stand on her head for 30 minutes after sex. And he mentioned these thoughts to Rosie that night, and she laughed, and told him that her mother wasn't allowed in their bedroom anyway, and that she wasn't going to be standing on her head after making love for anybody. Mrs. Noah has a flat in Williamstown, near Spider and Rosie's house, and twice a week one of Callianne Higgler's many nieces looks in on her, does the vacuuming, dusts the glass fruit, the wax fruit melted in the island heat, and makes a little food and leaves it in the fridge. And sometimes Rosie's mom eats it, and sometimes